I'm Jessica from Poker Face Productions. Thank you so much for your interest in and support of my Relevant to Now lecture series. I named it Relevant to Now because each of the speakers has made me think very carefully about important issues that are relevant to now, to our time in history. I chose to do the series leading up to the November election because the election is an opportunity for everyone to use what they know and what they might learn during this series to have an effect on shaping our time in history. We have one more in the series next Wednesday, the 27th, Dr. Danaher of Global Exchange. I'd like to remind anyone that doesn't or that isn't familiar with the hall that we do have seating up in the balcony in case anyone's looking for more seating. And I would like to ask everyone to please turn their cell phones off so as not to disrupt the presentation. And it also might disrupt the microphone that Mike is going to be using. Tonight's speaker, as you all know, is Mr. Mike Rupert, publisher and editor of the print newsletter and website From the Wilderness. He's the man that started it all for me. My truth is that before 9/11, I didn't pay much attention to politics. After 9/11, I saw his video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, which completely changed my world. The information his video provided was an investigational catalyst for me. Through my own research, I discovered the works of Dr. Caldicott and Dr. Danaher, among many others. I felt compelled to make a personal contribution by putting this series together to help the speakers get their very important messages out to more people. Mr. Rupert has a political science degree from UCLA. He is a former LAPD narcotics investigator who discovered CIA drug trafficking in the 70s. Since 9/11, he has been instrumental in breaking stories involving government corruption, foreknowledge, and violations of the Constitution, and he has pioneered the effort to educate the world about peak oil. I would like to thank my partner, Brent, for his invaluable contribution to this series. I am incredibly honored to present to you Mr. Mike Rupert. What?
When it starts off like that, what I want to do is just leave because, you know, how does it get any better than that? We did it. We did it. I do not use the word we lightly. For those of you, has anybody actually read this beast yet from cover to cover? All right. If you have, thank you. If you have, you know how many people I have thanked in this book for awesome, incredible research and courage and patience and wading through tons and tons of bullshit and needless wasted stuff to contribute an accurate, credible, ethically sound, journalistically professional, and more important, legally solid body of evidence. So I stand here tonight as the guy who wrote this book, who did a lot of the investigation, but I also stand here because of all the people whose names are mentioned in this book who made it happen. And I want to start off by saying that real clearly, and I thank them from the bottom of my heart. And I think we all as Americans should probably thank them. Probably before we do, this is not going to be... I saw people coming in with sleeping bags and changes of clothes. This is not going to be my standard 3 or 4 hour lecture with 3 hours of Q&A afterwards. We don't have to do that now. That's why we have the book in the back, and I encourage you to get that. We're going to do about an hour and 15-minute presentation about the book and what's in it, current events. Then I'll take your questions for about an hour, and then for those of you who buy the book tonight, I'll be staying in the back to autograph copies until we get them all done, because that's my way of saying thanks to all of you, too. There's been a lot of questions about the book. It's been available now for only about 3 weeks, I would guess. We got the first copy. And those of you who have been activists for a long time know that there is a history in this country of books that challenge the status quo, which get sabotaged in any number of creative ways. There were books by Fletcher Prouty where the entire first printing was purchased by the CIA, Peter Dale Scott where the book was on sale for about 3 days, and then all of the copies were remaindered to Saskatchewan or someplace in Canada. I mean, there are many ways to sabotage books, and I benefit greatly. I don't know if any of you heard KPFA today. I was on Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And And my dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz, the former Assistant Secretary of Housing, who wrote the foreword for the book. And it's hot up here. I'm taking my coat off. And what she taught me more than anything else was that nobody is as smart as all of us. And she also taught me a lot about how to vote with our money. And because of the things she taught me, this is a woman who had been a managing director at Dillon Reed on Wall Street, former Assistant Secretary of Housing, MBA from Wharton. We went into this, and my agent, publicist, manager, good friend Ken Levine is back there, and he put the book publishing deal together, and this book wouldn't be here if it were not for Ken. He negotiated a contract and got the attention of the right people to get it out before the election. But what Catherine taught me was to vote with money. Now, we had a strategy on if it went to the publisher, because we have a Canadian publisher, that it might be prevented from reaching U.S. markets. So From the Wilderness, my newsletter, because of the power all of the subscribers have given me, and I've kept a promise I made at Portland State in November of 2001. How many have seen the video Truth and Lies of 9/11? Did I not make a promise in that video that every penny I got would go into hiring more writers, to writing more stories, to expanding our ability to tell you the truth? I had two writers then. Today I got seven. I got Stan Goff, God bless his heart. I got Dale Allen Pfeiffer. I got Jamie Hecht. I got Michael Caine, Suzanne Mazur. I got some incredible, and that's, I'm still living in the same single apartment and still driving a nine-year-old Ford. Okay? But look at what From the Wilderness has done. And you gave us the power to do that. So we bought 20,000 copies of the book, and we put them up on sale on our website. And when Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everybody else saw that we were getting the money, suddenly they had the books. We have to play the money the way they do. Now, we're still having some problems here and there, but we have been as high as 38 on the Amazon bestseller list, and that's before any of our advertising has hit. That's out of 500,000 titles. And we're going to have some big surprises coming up. This book has just begun to have an impact, and I want to thank you for all the help you've given us on that. So that's for you. Okay, let's have some fun. What's in the book? Now, this is some of this stuff is going to be new, especially for those of you who haven't read the book. But this will be the short talking point, and Ken is going to have me on a lot of TV and radio shows, a lot of things talking about this book, and I want you to hear what I think is the central point to hook all those people out there in the country who are starting to go, draft? Peak oil? $60 a barrel? What's going on around here? There are some easy hooks in this book. You don't have to present it as 700 pages. You can present the easy hooks, but here's the basic summation. The high points that I want to put in here for you. There's a lot of other sizzle and sex and intrigue and drama and rock and roll, and that's all in the book. How else do you get anybody to read a 700-page book? Unless they're an academic. Any PhDs in the audience? No. Okay, good. Okay. Well, that's okay. That's token. That's okay. You know, we're not out of balance. Any lawyers in the room tonight? I want to hear from lawyers who read the book. I think we've made an incredible case that I would be proud to take to a district attorney to indict Richard Cheney, George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, all of them for murder, premeditated murder, and nothing less. Okay, so we know historically that we had plans to seize Iraqi oil going back to 1995. One of the earliest stories I broke after 9/11 was when I discovered or was turned on to a little book by Zbigniew Brzezinski called The Grand Chessboard, written in 1997, where he had these great quotes that the American people, absent a direct external military threat, would not support the imperial mobilization necessary to control the Eurasian continent, or the attacks of Pearl Harbor. He made multiple references. But this map that you see on the screen behind me is a map he put, and the dotted line is inside the dotted line is where he said the next world conflict was going to break out. And since that map was published in 1997, 4 years before 9/11, at LAPD, I said we call that a clue, that somebody had an idea. We also wrote, and one of the key things that I've put together that I'm probably proudest of, that was one of my own, purely my contribution to this was the overwhelming evidence that the National Energy Policy Development Group, Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, which convened and started shop like 3 days after the inauguration of the Bush administration, deliberated in secret until May of 2001 and has still refused to release its records, was talking about this situation that we call peak oil. And we have produced records on that, and we have put records together. And one of the stories that we did, thanks to two civil suits filed by the Sierra Club and Judicial Watch, 7 pages of the thousands of pages of documents actually did surface. And we found maps of Iraqi oil fields, Saudi oil fields, and oil fields in the United Arab Emirates, which when we put the maps together, what you see is the triangle behind me on the screen. And inside that triangle, and you just see the comparison and how easily it fits into Texas, if you just enlarge that triangle just a little bit that way, you have encompassed 60% of all the known recoverable oil on planet Earth. And look at the area that it's in. From the official energy policy, the official report that came out in May 2001, America in the year 2001 faces the most serious energy shortage since the oil embargoes of the 1970s. Estimates indicate that over the next 20 years, U.S. oil consumption will increase by 33%, natural gas consumption by well over 50%, and demand for electricity will rise by 45%. U.S. energy consumption is expected to increase by about 32% by 2020. I'm going to scare the bejesus out of you later on with some numbers that really scare me. Between 2000 and 2020, U.S. natural gas demand is projected by the Energy Information Administration to increase by more than 50%. Yet we produce 39% less oil today than we did in 1970, the peak year of production in the U.S., leaving us ever more reliant on foreign suppliers. On our present course, America 20 years from now will import nearly 2 of every 3 barrels of oil, a condition of increased dependency on foreign powers that do not always have America's interests at heart. Dick Cheney was talking about that long before 9/11 and long before Iraq. Everybody does know there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There weren't. Okay, that, you know, we were lied to. You've all kind of got that picture, right? Well, the part of the book tells you, because what I deal with is means, motive, and opportunity, like a homicide detective would, and laying out the motive for the crime of 9/11, I talk about the fact that not only is the world running out of oil, but there was no other place to go to get it, and it had become a matter of musical chairs. As we proceed a little further in this brief background looking at the motive, there's a quote. ABC News actually reported this on February 11th of this year. In his just-released book, Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil, published by W.W. Norton, Professor Goodstein argues forcefully that the worldwide production of oil will peak soon, probably within this decade. And I personally am convinced that right now, in 2004, we are plus or minus 1 year away from the all-time peak of global oil production and beginning an irreversible decline in production. That will be followed by declining availability of fossil fuels that could plunge the world into global conflicts as nations struggle to capture their piece of a shrinking pie. Professor Goldstein is a physics professor and vice chancellor of the California Institute of Technology. No credentials whatsoever. Now, setting the stage for September 11th, and what happened on September 11th began back in the Clinton administration. And I spend a great deal of time documenting how the legends of the 19 hijackers had begun to be created under the Clinton administration, how the Taliban was protected, especially by one individual, an assistant secretary of state named Carl Rick Inderfirth, how we had known that such an attack was going to be necessary, certainly since 97, because that's when Brzezinski started talking about the need for such an attack. But there are indications which, in a criminal case, or if I was a detective, would go to premeditation to show that someone was planning to have these events take place. A key document was a White House press release from the Office of the Press Secretary dated May 8, 2001. I'm just going to read you two short excerpts here. The whole document is contained in its entirety in the book. Domestic preparedness against weapons of mass destruction. Protecting America's homeland and citizens from the threat of weapons of mass destruction is one of our nation's important national security challenges. Later on it says, today numerous federal departments and agencies have programs to deal with the consequences of a potential use of chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear weapons inside the U.S. Many of these federal programs offer training, planning, assistance to state and local governments. But to maximize their effectiveness, these efforts need to be seamlessly integrated, harmonious, and comprehensive. Seamlessly integrated, harmonious, and comprehensive. Now, that would include, would it not, would you think, hijacked airliners being used as bombs? Yes, it would have to, in other words, to be seamless. Now, on May 8, 2001, President Bush stated, this is his statement, therefore, I have asked Vice President Cheney to oversee development of a coordinated national effort so that we may do the very best possible job of protecting our people from catastrophic harm. I have also asked Joe Alba, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to create an Office of National Preparedness. The office will be responsible for implementing the results of those parts of the national effort overseen by Vice President Cheney. In other words, FEMA will implement what Cheney decides. He has complete operational control. Specifically, it will control all federal programs dealing with weapons of mass destruction, consequence management within the Departments of Defense, Health and Human Services, Justice and Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other federal agencies. In other words, everything. The Office of National Preparedness will work closely with state and local governments to ensure their planning, training, and equipment needs. Training. That includes war game exercises. Remember that. Planning, training, and equipment needs are addressed. FEMA will also work closely with the DOJ in its lead role for crisis management to ensure that all facets of our response to the threat from weapons of mass destruction are coordinated and cohesive. There's not much doubt about who was put in charge of everything, the planning, the training, and everything else by the president in May of 2001. Just a month later, on June 1st of 2001, another directive appeared for the North American Aerospace Defense Command. That's NORAD. That's the Air Force Command that controls all fighter response inside the continental United States. And basically, the short version of what you're looking at, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs Instruction, CJSI 3610.01A, is basically that fighters can't be scrambled now unless you get clearance directly from the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Fighters had more autonomous authority to scramble, and in fact, the Associated Press told us that in the calendar year, and this was also reported by a British Member of Parliament, Michael Meacher, the former cabinet minister, that 67 times in the calendar year prior to June 1, 2001, any time a commercial airliner or other aircraft under instrument flight rules was off course, fighters were scrambled and flying beside it within a matter of minutes. Worked 67 times perfectly before 9/11, yet it failed completely on 9/11. There are some exceptions to this, allowing commanders to make decisions in exigent circumstances, and I talk about that a great deal in the book. My father, during the Korean War, flew in the back seat. That's a F-89 Scorpion interceptors, and we were stationed in Maine. He was waiting for the Russian bombers to come over the pole. And I was raised into the Air Force culture. And no Air Force pilot, especially of an interceptor or air crew, combat air crew, would ever sit by and let this country be attacked if they were waiting for an order, if they knew where the enemy was. They trained their whole lives for these missions. So something had to have happened to prevent that. And what was it that happened? Well, on the day of September the 11th, I have identified... Now, this is just talking about the Air Force right now. We're talking about NORAD and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There are many commands within the Air Force and above the Air Force, but which can control the Air Force. As many as four separate war game exercises that were simultaneously in progress on the morning of September 11th as the hijackings began. One of those was Vigilant Guardian. Multiple press sources are very clear that Vigilant Guardian was a hijack exercise. It was called a command post exercise. How many people have military experience? Okay, if you know what a CPX is, a CPX is not where you go out and run around in the field and do things. It's an exercise where you have electronic simulations in your command post, and you don't necessarily go out in the field. But you can have things like inserted radar blips on a screen. You can have communications about hijacked aircraft. Vigilant Guardian was operating in the Northeast Air Defense Sector where all four hijackings took place, all four of them, confirmed by multiple sources. Now, we're going to see the government lying about that in a second. A second drill, how many people have read Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies? If you read that book as hard as I did, you will find some clues which he must have left there deliberately. I think that man is very angry because he left clues which absolutely condemned the Bush administration, and I think George Bush himself must have censored the book because he let all the errors through. He let all the clues through. Not that I'm making any comment about the president's intelligence. Although if on one of the back pages here, you will see me describe the president, but the one and only time I do describe him in the book, as a mentally ill, empty suit. Other than that, I have no opinion. I have to be open about this stuff. Now, for anybody out there who says, oh, he's a damn Democrat, how many people know that I don't endorse the Democrats either? Okay? All right? All right. Richard Clark talks about this exercise. He talks about they're in the White House Situation Room, and he gets the White House Situation Room is above ground in the White House, and he's there with Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, and a few other people, and they're trying to play this game of running the whole national response. Well, the real national response was actually being run downstairs in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or the bunker underneath the White House. That's where Dick Cheney was issuing his orders with a completely separate command and control system. We'll get to that. But he gets General Richard Myers on the phone, and in the Clark's book, he says, General Myers says, yeah, we're right in the middle of Vigilant Warrior, a training exercise. So now I got a second exercise. Then we have Northern Guardian, which is mentioned in the Toronto Star, and Northern Vigilance. Now, Northern Guardian may or may not be, I haven't found anything else except for one mention, so I'm going to say that's a possible. But Northern Vigilance is definitely a real war game, and that's one where almost all, a significant number of fighters, the actual number is classified, according to NORAD. One of the things where my writing and journalism is different on 9/11 from most other authors is I actually go out and ask people questions. I actually go out and dig up documents. And I talk in the book about role-playing. I wanted to do it like Detective Sipowicz from NYPD Blue, you know, where you can throw some people around, a little bit. But I'm a journalist now. I don't have a badge and a gun, no authority, so I kind of had to do it like Columbo, you know. You mentioned this exercise, and you got that, and I can't, can you help me? And it works. It works. Believe me. I'll show you how well it worked. Northern Vigilance pulled an unspecified number, it's classified, of fighters out of the Northeast Air Defense Sector, and indeed from all over the country, for a war game exercise that actually was about Russian bombers coming over the pole to bomb the United States. Now, somebody, I'm assuming, has told the Air Force that the Soviet Union ceased to exist in 1989. Or 1990. No, 91, excuse me. The Berlin Wall came down in 89. It's like, what's that all about? But they took fighters out so that there were only eight fighter aircraft anywhere in the Northeast Air Defense Sector on the morning of 9/11. Anybody who knows anything about the Air Force knows that fighters always fly in pairs. Interceptors do. Pilot and wingman. That means there was only four possible hijacks that could have been responded to, even if they knew where to go. And yet I document in the book that they had as many as 22 possible hijackings in progress because of the war games. And they couldn't tell what was what. Who did that? Okay. You get a prize. That's good. That's payoff for me when I hear those. Okay. Northern Vigilance, and then the National Reconnaissance Office in Washington, or outside of Dulles Airport, actually, in Virginia, which is run by the CIA and the Air Force, was coincidentally running a plane into building exercise. It was a command post exercise, no lifeline on that day. So my first question, as I discover all these exercises, and I owe a debt of gratitude who I thank in the book, and I thank publicly again to researcher Barbara Honegger, who wrote a book about the October surprise. She kept hammering on me about the war games. There was some misunderstanding about what she was saying. I thought she was saying that Al-Qaeda had somehow put a spy inside of NORAD and found out about the war games, and I just can't see that that happened. You know, he would have had to shave his beard, and you just can't do that. But she kept hammering until I saw the significance of the war games, and then I analyzed how they had worked together to paralyze fighter response. Now, what I found, and you'll see a lot of documented interviews in the book or a lot of press stories where I found that the FAA air traffic controllers were absolutely horrified. Interesting that a tape made by the air traffic controllers in Boston, who handled the first three hijackings, was destroyed. It was reported destroyed 24 hours after I wrote my official questions to NORAD. And that was where they recounted everything that was going on. But we document in abundance earlier on in the book the number of warnings that had been given the United States government about planes being hijacked, crashed into buildings, World Trade Center, Pentagon. We even proved that they were running drills. Now, this was a time of heightened terror. Remember the presidential daily brief? Remember the John Ashcroft stopped flying commercially? Remember everybody was worried about the hijackings and all that? So my first question was, being a detective, what idiot would schedule four simultaneous war game exercises that absolutely debilitated the United States Air Force on the morning of 9/11? And it took me 3.5 months to find out the idiot was Dick Cheney. Ooh, I like it. All right. Now, this is just confirmation of the fact that pilots were going to take off and base commanders if they had a clue that the country was under attack. Remember, these guys train 20, 30 years, and these are hotshot fighter pilots. I mean, major testosterone levels, lots of adrenaline. I want to kill something. I'm the best. I'm the baddest. I was that way when I was a cop, so I understand that. I used to be a cop. And then the real attack finally comes. This is my chance. Put me in, coach. I mean, these guys are not going to sit by for anything. So the fighters were going to take off. They had to know where to go. General Arnold, who was the commander of 1st Air Force, or CONAR, which is a unit of NORAD, out of Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, said, scramble the planes. Get them up. What everybody covered up was that nobody knew where to go. Now, let's take a closer look at some of these exercises. Vigilant Guardian. This is what the U.S. government tried to tell us, and this is also what the Kane Commission told us. By the way, let me just dispense briefly with the Kane Commission. They all belong in jail. They're all liars. They have all committed enormous crimes, including subornation of perjury, evidence tampering, and obstruction of justice. They all have massive personal conflict of interest. They should never have been allowed to judge it. And before they issued their final report, they changed evidence previously submitted to the Kane Commission on their own and produced a document that didn't bear any relation to any of the testimony or evidence that had ever been submitted beforehand. Other than that, there was nothing wrong with them at all. The official government version was NORAD has confirmed it was running two mock drills on September 11th at various radar sites and command centers in the U.S. and Canada, including Air Force bases in upstate New York, Florida, Washington, and Alaska. Upstate New York, that's important. That's Northeast Air Defense Sector. One drill, Operation Vigilant Guardian, began a week before and reflected a Cold War mindset. No, that was Northern Vigilance that was the Cold War drill. This is from NewJersey.com quoting NORAD officers. So they're trying to lie to us now about what the games did. Northern Vigilance, which was the actual drill, and I got this directly quoting from a NORAD spokesperson, Major Maria Kwan, who emailed me back on April 21, 2004. She said, and she directed me to a press release, the North American Aerospace Defense Command shall deploy fighter aircraft as necessary to forward operating locations in Alaska and northern Canada to monitor a Russian Air Force exercise in the Russian Arctic and North Pacific Ocean. So this press release from NORAD contradicts flatly both the Kane Commission and the official statements of the United States government about what Vigilant Guardian was. So this is also a clue for those of you who have not been in law enforcement. When you catch suspects lying, there's a clue that they might be guilty for something. It's just something you learn. Northern Vigilance, what did it do? Listen to this. This is from the Toronto Star, December 9th, 2001. Northern Vigilance, planned month in advance, involves deploying fighter jets to locations in Alaska and northern Canada. Part of the exercise, now see, this again goes back, but it's using the right name, Northern Vigilance. Part of the exercise is pure simulation, but part is real world. When you're talking about that, you're talking about live fly exercises, where aircraft go up and pose as hijacked aircraft. My father flew intercept missions, and Dad confirmed with me, anybody who's done combat time or flying time in the Air Force in any kind of an intercept or tactical role understands that when you train for this, you actually go up and fly because planes pose as the bad guys. Why? Because if you're practicing intercept, which means you fly above and to the left, and you fly in and rock your wings, and you're supposed to rock, and then you go off. Or the, if they don't, then you have to go back and go below, check the airplane out. You have to practice a missile lock. If the plane tries evasive action, the fighter pilot has to follow, and that's a live fly exercise to train the pilots. Pilots cannot intercept thin air, not in war game exercises. That doesn't train them very well. That would be like me as a policeman working narcotics in South Central, training to be involved in a shooting with thin air. You can't do that. You have to train with real things, real world. NORAD is keeping a close eye on the Russians, who have dispatched long-range bombers to their own high north. The Federal Aviation Administration has evidence of a hijacking and is asking NORAD for support. This is not part of the exercise. Big emphasis there. This is when the real hijackings come in. But what does the next part of the story say? In a flash, Operation Northern Vigilance is called off. Any simulated information, what's known as an inject, is purged from the screens. Now we have a confirmation in the Toronto Star, who they interviewed NORAD officers, command officers, including Major General Rick Findlay, who is a Canadian at NORAD, and you have a confirmation that there are false radar injects on the radar screens on the morning of 9/11. Lots of other reports were starting to come in. Major General Findlay recalls, and now you're not too sure if they're that clever to coordinate that kind of attack. What else is taking place across North America? That was his quote. That whole passage never made it into an American newspaper. If we come a little further, NORAD had an exercise. There were some great stories that came out of CNN. Believe it or not, they actually leaked some stuff, which they didn't want to leak. And from USA Today. If you watch the mainstream press closely and you learn how to read them, you can find all kinds of damning stuff, but it just takes time to piece it together. CNN, sometime between 91 and 2001, a regional sector of the North American Aerospace Defense Command simulated a foreign hijacked airliner crashing into a building in the United States as part of a training exercise scenario, a NORAD spokesman said Monday. Now reconcile that with Condoleezza Rice's statement that we had absolutely no idea that anyone would ever use a plane as a weapon. Military officials said the exercise involved simulating a crash into a building that would be recognizable if identified, but was not the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Okay, CIA headquarters, White House. The sector exercise involved some flying of military aircraft, confirming live fly hijack drills about planes being crashed into buildings. As well as a command post exercise that just takes place in the headquarters, in which communications procedures were practiced. NORAD has the ongoing mission of defense. According to the statement from NORAD, before 9/11, NORAD regularly conducted a variety of exercises that included hijack scenarios. These exercises tested track detection, that's on the radar screen, and identification. But where it says scramble and interception, hijack procedures, you can only do that in the Air Force in a live fly exercise where somebody's posing as a hijacked airliner. And the way, how do they pose as hijacked airliners? They go to the boneyard, they get a 757 or a 767, or they call up the airlines and say, you got a plane that's not doing anything, we need it for an exercise. Sometimes they actually shoot them down. And they fly almost all of those by, guess what? Remote control. Ah, wait a minute, can I get another? Well, thank you. Okay, I love it when they do that. Okay. Vigilant Guardian was a hijack drill, not a Cold War exercise. And here, ABC News. Broke some stuff. The first thing that went through my mind, quote, after receiving the hijacking alert for Flight 11 was, quote, is this part of the exercise? Is this some kind of a screw-up? This was a quote from ABC News interviewing, I believe it was Major Don Deskins or Light Colonel Don Deskins at Northeast Air Defense Sector. Second quote, Tech Sergeant Jeremy Powell of Northeast Air Defense Sector in Rome, New York, took the call from Boston Center. He notified Needs Commander Colonel Robert Marr of a possible hijacked airliner. Quote, part of the exercise, the colonel wondered. No, this is a real-world event, he was told, several days into a semi-annual exercise known as Vigilant Guardian. Aviation Week in Space Technology gave us that little gem. That was, here's the next quote. Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins figured it would be a long day. September 11th was day two of Vigilant Guardian, an exercise that would pose an imaginary crisis to North America air defense outposts nationwide. At 8:40, Deskins noticed senior technician Jeremy Powell waving his hand. Boston Center was on the line. He said it had a hijacked airliner. Quote, it must be part of the exercise, Deskins thought. Newhouse News Service. Vigilant Warrior. Now we're getting to where it's really going to be fun. FAA Administrator Jane Garland. This is quoting now from Richard Clark's book, and he does a pretty decent job of recreating the docudrama aspects of the White House Situation Room. That's upstairs. That's not PEOC. FAA Administrator Jane, this is him talking. Jane, where's Norm? He's asking about Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, I asked. They were frantically looking for Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, and like me, a rare holdover from the Clinton administration. At first, FAA could not find him. Quote, well, Jane, can you order aircraft down? We're going to have to clear the airspace around Washington and New York. Quote, we may have to do a lot more than that, Dick. I already put a hold on all takeoffs and landings in New York and Washington, but we have reports of 11 aircraft off course or out of communications, maybe hijacked. 11! Now, you are General Larry Arnold at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida or Colonel Robert Marr at Needs, and you have the ability in the Northeast Air Defense Sector to respond to four possible hijackings, and you have 11. How many people would send fighters not knowing if you were sending them to the right place? Aircraft scrambles are paralyzed until you know exactly where your target is, because if you send them 500 miles in that direction and that turns out to be a fake and your real hijack is back over here, what happens? You're too late. Maybe 11 aircraft. Clark says, I turn to the radar screens. JCS, that's Joint Chiefs of Staff, top of the military command. I assume NORAD has scrambled fighters and AWACS. How many? Where? Not a pretty picture, Dick. Dick Myers, himself a fighter pilot, knew that the days when we had scores of fighters on strip alert ended with the Cold War. We are in the middle of Vigilant Warrior, a NORAD exercise, but Otis has launched two birds toward New York. Langley is trying to get up to two up now. It was now 9:28. So there's Richard Clark's statement about Vigilant Warrior. I was in my role as Columbo going, what madman scheduled and coordinated all these exercises on the same day? Nobody would answer. 15-20 phone calls. NORAD, Tyndall, Department of Defense. Nobody answered. Emails. Finally, NORAD emails back. It's all classified. I can't say anything. One guy gets back to me. Now, Kyle Hentz, an activist in 9/11, who has did a great job of dogging every 9/11 commission hearing just about and cornering people in elevators. He followed them around. And he actually gave me a business card for a Major Don Arias, who is the press spokesman at Tyndall Air Force Base for the 1st Air Force. He was working with General Arnold that day. So I called up several times, and I got to speak to Arias, and I put on my best. I'm an Air Force brat, and I talked all the airplane stuff that I knew how to talk, and I know how to talk it pretty good. Where my dad had served, he'd worked with Martin Marietta. My mother had been a cryptanalyst for Secretary of State Cordell Hull during the Second World War. So I had him going, and he was friendly. Finally, I sent him a final email. I said, look, somebody's got to answer me. All these names of the war games have meanings. I've known that for a long time. How do you decipher them? And I sent, and you can read it all in the book. The emails are all in there, in the book. where I laid it out. So you couldn't read my question without knowing that I knew that somebody had deliberately committed murder and paralyzed the U.S. Air Force. Finally, on May 14th, an email comes in from Don Arias. And at the bottom of the email, it's in the book, NORAD Instruction 33-7, nicknames, a combination of two separate unclassified words which is assigned an unclassified meaning. A nickname is used exclusively to designate a drill or exercise. Exercise terms are used to prevent confusion between exercise directives with actual operations. I've developed other information showing that there's always been a firewall in between drills and operations, yet on 9/11 that firewall did not exist. The injects were on the FAA and U.S. Air Force radar screens. The fake hijackings were taking place on the same communications channels. The firewall had broken down. So Don Arias emails and says, vigilant or amalgam means it is a headquarters NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command. That's headquartered in Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs. Sponsored exercise. Guardian means it is a multi-command command post exercise. No live fly. That's where you do the electronics and you simulate the message and okay, you read this and that happens and the guys in the command post do that. So on 9/11, NORAD was conducting a NORAD-wide multi-command command post exercise with no live fly. But then he adds at the bottom, other exercise items include Warrior. Remember Vigilant Warrior? That's Richard Myers. Warrior equals JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Headquarters NORAD, sponsored FTX, or Field Training Exercise, parentheses, live fly. That's a written confirmation from an Air Force spokesman that on the day of 9/11, the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Richard Myers was conducting a live-fly hijack drill with aircraft posing as hijacked airliners. Has anybody ever told you about that? Yes. That's how I felt when I got this. Now, let's talk about Don Arias for a moment, because I really like this guy. I did some checking on Don Arias. A couple other people caught it about the same time I did. Funny thing happened on 9/11. He was interviewed that night, and ABC picked it up, and one other newspaper picked it up, that during the middle of the hijackings, and actually it was the point. Everybody know now, just briefly, let me tell you, and we have a great long timeline in here that makes it easy to go cross-hack your times to see what was going on, that Flight 175 was the second hijacking. Flight 11 hit the North Tower at about 8:56, I think it was. Don't quote me exactly, or 8:46. And 9:03 was the time that Flight 175 hit the South Tower. But it had been known that Flight 175 had been hijacked for about 25 minutes and was heading toward New York. And the funny thing is, nobody picked up the phone to call the people in the World Trade Center. Do you remember they told the people to go back to their desks in both buildings? So I find this story, and what happens during the window when they know that Flight 175 is hijacked before it hits? Don Arias leaves his post, walks to a telephone, dials a number. His brother works in the World Trade Center. He says, get the hell out of the building, hangs up the phone, and goes back to his post. Why? Because nobody in the United States government was issuing any warning, even though they knew that 175 was on its way to become the second plane to hit because Flight 11 had already hit. And a guy in the most powerful military in the world had to use a standard telephone to tell his brother to get out of the building. Now, if we take this a little further about what was revealed to us, how does that make you feel, by the way? You should see how I nail Rudolph Giuliani for committing perjury about what he knew and when on September the 11th. I got him nailed. They won't even put his testimony on the site because they know I got him nailed. And again, I have to thank 9/11 researchers like Kyle Hentz, Joe Friendly, and somebody else who was listening. I think it was on the KPFA website up here. somebody had recorded Giuliani's testimony and transcribed it. I think it was available from the KPFA site. So I had two proofs of Giuliani's testimony. Caught him lying through his teeth. Now let's look a little bit deeper about how this worked. April 18th, 2004, USA Today spilled some beans. NORAD had drills of jets as weapons. Washington, in the 2 years before 9/11, the North American Aerospace Defense Command conducted exercises simulating what the White House says was unimaginable. Hijacked airliners as weapons to crash into targets. One of the imagined targets was the World Trade Center. In another exercise, jets performed a mock shootdown of the Atlantic Ocean of a jet supposedly laden with chemical poisons headed toward a target in the United States. Now, that was a weapon of mass destruction. Directly, clearly under the control of who? Dick Cheney, who was coordinating all the training and all the preparedness. In a third scenario, the target was the Pentagon, but that drill was not run after defense officials said it was unrealistic. Yeah, right. More confirmation of live fly. Numerous types of civilian and military aircraft were used as mocked and hijacked aircraft, the statement said. Whoa, USA Today. Live fly. We got hijacked airline. Okay, there it is, right there, black and white. A White House spokesman said Sunday that the Bush administration was unaware of the exercises. But the exercises using real aircraft show that at least one part of the government thought the possibility of such attacks, though unlikely, merited scrutiny. Until 9/11, NORAD was expected to defend the United States and Canada from aircraft based elsewhere. And I have this great line in the book. I said, okay, so who were they going to scramble if it wasn't NORAD? The LAPD? The Civil Air Patrol? No, not hardly. But there were exceptions, including one operation planned in July 2001 and conducted later that involved planes from airports in Utah and Washington that were hijacked. Those planes were escorted by U.S. and Canadian aircraft to airfields in British Columbia. So everything you've heard about 9/11 is a lie, officially. The NORAD statement went further, and basically it said here that all these drills always involved, I love this part, it says, these exercises were artificial simulations that provided us, this is a quote from NORAD, the opportunity to test and validate our process and rules of engagement with the appropriate coordination between NORAD's command headquarters, its subordinate regions and sectors, and the national command authorities in Canada and the U.S. You know what the national command authority is? The president. In his absence, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So now we know the White House was involved in all of these exercises. We're going to skip the NRO. Now, after all this, you okay? Fan mail from... It says duck. No, I'm kidding. If you don't have a sense of humor, what's the point? You take all this stuff too seriously, you know, you're getting a lot of trouble. Okay, after you've seen all of this documentary evidence about war games that you were not told anything about, what did the Independent Commission on 9/11 have to say about all these war games? You ready? The Office of National Preparedness, that's that thing that put everything under Dick Cheney's control, is not mentioned once in the entire report. Not once. As for the war game exercises, the only mention of any war game exercise was a footnote which mentioned only one exercise, Vigilant Guardian. But it continued the lie that that was part of the Russian attack scenario. And it's mentioned in footnote 116, not even in the body of the report. A footnote, way in the back. 116, it says, on 9/11, NORAD was scheduled to conduct a military exercise, Vigilant Guardian, which postulated a bomber attack from the former Soviet Union. We investigated whether military preparations for the large-scale exercise compromised the military's response to the real-world terrorist attack on 9/11. According to General Eberhardt, it took about 30 seconds to make the adjustment to real-world situation. Ralph Eberhardt, testimony, June 17, 2004. We found that response was, if anything, expedited by the increased number of staff at the sectors of NORAD and at NORAD because of the scheduled exercise. In other words, he's saying it was no problem. We were having this drill, and we fortunately had extra people on board, and so we went right to work. Whereas in the book, I present the documentation showing that FAA at one time had 22 possible hijackings they were trying to decipher. The air traffic controllers, there is one of the most heartbreaking stories about Ed Ballinger, one an air traffic controller on 9/11 who can't even work anymore. The air traffic controllers were crushed, and they carry a burden of guilt which no human being should have to live with because they were set up to take the fall on 9/11. So that's all the 9/11 Commission told you about the war games. On that basis alone, knowing that those war games existed, what happened and how they worked, right now, I'm sorry, we should stop the whole damn country until we get an answer on that. Period. Okay, now to the cheery part. Wish I had my laser pointer. I know, I always feel good with a laser pointer. It makes me feel powerful, yeah? Okay. Peak oil. The world is beginning to run out of hydrocarbon energy. Yeah, no, not too fast, please. It's going to be a little bit heavier than you think. You know, I have a lot of... There are critics who say that this is... anybody talking about the world running out of oil is all part of a Zionist conspiracy. And that oil is infinite, it comes out of the center of the earth, and, you know, there's plenty of... Okay, well, listen, I got news for you. The world's falling apart now. They're having blackouts in China. 9 or 10 governments are in emergency session. People are going to freeze to death this winter. If this oil is around, could somebody please bring it now? I mean, because this is not in anybody's interest, not even in the corporate structure, best interest, because economies are starting to collapse, and they will be collapsing next year. Ours will be one of them. So I'm going to give you a brief... overlook on peak oil and how it works and how it's playing out. All oil production, whether it's in one oil field in Texas or in Dubai or in any place else, always follows a bell curve, or planet Earth as a whole. You drill your first well, you get a gusher, then you start drilling more wells, your total production goes up to a bell curve, and then it tapers off and goes down. Once you pass the peak, no matter how much money, no matter how much technology, no matter how much effort you throw at it, you will never, ever, ever, ever be able to increase production again. Period. It's been proven. The man who developed this theory was a guy by the name, I'm going to go back forward and come back, was a guy named M. King Hubbard, a geologist, who predicted in 1953 that United States oil production would peak in 1970 or 71. And guess what? U.S. oil production peaked in 1971. It's been on a steady decline ever since. His science showed that the peak of production usually occurs about 40 years after the peak of discovery, whether it's in the United States or the planet. Well, if we go back, that's the Hubbard curve that I'm showing there. Global oil discoveries peaked in 1962, and they've been on a steady decrease ever since. I would say we're roughly about 40 years past 1962, aren't we? There's another group that says that the actual discoveries peaked in 64, okay? Peaked in the early 60s. We're 40 years past that now. And peak is here, plus or minus 1 year away. Let me give you a clue about oil production. You have to find it before you can pump it. Does that make sense? Okay? And it usually takes 3 to 5 years to bring a major oil field online once you've discovered the field. They thought there was a whole bunch of oil in the Caspian Basin in the late 90s, and this has a major role to do with how 9/11 came into being, because it was touted as 350 billion barrels. Put this in perspective, the planet Earth uses a billion barrels of oil every 11 and one-half days. 11 and one-half days, 1 billion barrels of oil. By 1997, 98, maybe there's 250 billion barrels of oil. Now it is known that there's no more than 40 billion barrels in the Caspian Basin. 20 out of 25 wells drilled between 1998 and 2000, 2001, were dry holes. They thought it was a vast sea of oil. It's isolated pockets. The first well was a dry hole. It cost $325 million to drill that well. You have to think about money as this happens. So the Caspian Basin's a bust. Global discoveries peaked, and I'll give you the outside date, 64. Last year, 2003, for the first time since the late 1920s, according to IHS, the world's premier petroleum consulting company, it only costs $30,000 to buy their annual report. $30,000. CIA buys the first copy every year. They probably steal it or help write it. Last year was the first time since the late 1920s when not a single field, a so-called mega field of 500 million barrels, was discovered. 500 million barrels. That's about a five-day supply for planet Earth. We didn't find one field for that. And yet, according to Dick Cheney's report, Professor Michael Clare, a colleague who I've met in Paris and Berlin at peak oil conferences, did some analysis on what the Cheney Task Force said, and he said, oh, it's very simple. In the next 20 years, the United States will have to come up with 7.5 million barrels a day of new oil just to meet increased demand here. And the 7.5 million barrels that the U.S. is going to have to find is equal to what China and India consume today. That's going to get much scarier. But what happens, if you look at the red line, is hydrocarbon production. See the green line? That's population. And the creaming curves, or the little dots here on the left, show actual versus the predicted. So it shows that everything is skewed back a little this way along the timeline. The dips there are when we had the Arab oil embargoes of the 70s, which was an artificial thing. Peak would have probably arrived a lot sooner had we not had the 73, 74, and 77 oil embargoes. But you see a population overshoot. Here's another piece of fun information for you. There are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food you eat. 10 calories of hydrocarbon. Why? Well, you plant a crop. How do you plant a crop? You drive an oil-powered machine to till the land. Then you drive another oil-powered machine to plant the seeds. Then you got to irrigate it. Well, how do you irrigate it? With water? Well, how's that pumped? Electricity. How do you make the electricity? Natural gas or oil or coal to make the electricity. Then you spray them with fertilizers. What are all the fertilizers made from? Natural gas. Ammonia is made from natural gas. What are all commercial pesticides made from? Oil. So when the plant's all grown up and you've used all this oil to get it there, then you got to harvest it with another oil-powered machine. You got to drive it to a food processing plant with another oil-powered machine where it's processed with electricity, which is more hydrocarbon energy. Then you wrap it in plastic, which is oil. Then you drive it by another oil-powered machine to a supermarket where you go and whoop out your plastic ATM card and pay for it, take it home and put on a plastic plate, which is made out of oil, throw it in a microwave oven, which is run by electricity, made by hydrocarbon energy, and then you eat it. 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food on the planet. I'll skip this. I predicted the last year's August blackout 6 weeks before it happened. I was just following natural gas storage levels in North America. Natural gas is worse than oil. Oil seeps down into interstitial rocks, and you got to go into secondary recovery. Once you hit peak, let me go back here for a second. Once you hit peak, stands to reason we've picked all the low-hanging fruit. Human beings, right? You want an apple, do you take the nice juicy one that's hanging right down, or do you get a ladder and climb all the way up to the top of the tree? You pick the low-hanging fruit first. We have used the low-hanging fruit. We have also used most of the light sweet crude. Saudi Arabia cannot increase production. They're at or near peak now. Ghawar, the single largest oil field in the planet, is on the verge of collapse due to water injection. And if Ghawar collapses, the whole world economic system will start to end within 24 hours to 48 hours of that news reaching the markets. 25% of all the recoverable oil on the planet's in Saudi Arabia. But it's not all oil is not the same. Light sweet crude makes gasoline. What Saudi Arabia has been able to increase is with heavy sour oil, which is sulfur. You know what you make out of that? Asphalt. Now, do we need more asphalt now? See, this game gets really complex after a while. Every barrel of oil gets more expensive to produce as you go down the curve, and it's lesser quality oil. And you have smaller fields because we found all the big fields. So when you have that field go up, you got to go drill and find another one. But then you got a, you know, 1 in 5, 1 in 10, 1 in 15 wells is going to be a producing well, but you got to throw all the cash away as you go to drill the dry holes to find the ones that produce oil. There will always be oil in the ground, always, because an oil field is dry or dead when it takes more energy to produce a barrel of oil out of the ground than you get from burning the oil. Duh. Or, conversely, oil will stay in the ground as long as the price of oil makes it profitable to pull the barrel of oil up. Why would you spend $60 to pull a barrel of oil out of the ground when the price of oil is only $40? Ah, we're nearing $60 now. Oil's going to be at $100 soon. And of course, the Treasury is, the Fed especially, they're upping the M3 money supply. And the real reason, two reasons why we invaded Iraq. One, it's got around 100 billion barrels of oil that's in the ground. The infrastructure's shot, but the neocons are saying, that's okay, it's in the bank and we own the land. Okay, but the second reason is because Iraq was pricing in euros. Now, guess what? Now, all this big talk about Iran. Now, how many people have kind of got the idea that invading Iran is about one of the stupidest things that's ever been mentioned anywhere in this country's history? You're aware of the fact that the military is overstretched, the Guard and Reserve are being held 6 months, a year and a half under stop-loss orders. That's a backdoor draft right now. There are desertions. There are AWOLs. We have a class action suit filed from Northern California from a guardsman saying, I'm not going back. You can't make me go back. That's illegal. We're having mutinies. We're going to be fighting in West Africa soon. I've been predicting that for a long time. Now we want to go invade Iran. And, of course, John Kerry says, I'll increase the army by 200,000 men. But there won't be a draft. What? How many people have visited my website from the wilderness? Okay. Bless you all. Thank you. So you've seen our stories on the draft and the wonderful work done by Stan Goff. I mean, the arithmetic is so simple. Okay, so, you know, this is part of the insanity that's going on here is that we've decided to go fight and steal the oil wherever we have to go. So, but guess, here's the deal about Iran. Next year, nobody's told you this, Iran is planning on opening a commodities trading market for oil to compete with NYMEX in New York and the IPC in London pricing oil in euros. Yeah. That's why they want, that's why Bush wants to invade Iran. And he would even do that because that will collapse the dollar. You collapse the dollar, and see, the only reason we get to live so good in this country is because anybody in the world wants to buy oil, they have to buy dollars first. So if the price of oil goes up, our dollars work for us. You take away the dollar pricing, the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, the dollars flood home, now we have to print money, and we are now living in the Weimar Republic, for those of you who know what the Weimar Republic was. That's before Adolf Hitler, when it took several million marks to buy a loaf of bread. They would shovel wheelbarrows full of German marks, and that would buy a, you know, that's hyperinflation. But energy and money are the same thing. If you take out, let's say this was a barrel of oil, and I take out a bill out of my wallet here, and I put that there, and I study these for long enough, and I say, okay, what do these represent? Money itself, this doesn't have any power. I mean, it's just a piece of paper, right? It's got ink on it and all that stuff. It represents the ability to do work. I can give this $20 to somebody and he'll clean my driveway, or you know, I can buy some groceries, or it represents the ability to do work, which involves what? The expenditure of energy. Energy is the ability to do work. So these two are absolute, like Siamese conjoined twins. But we live in an economy that is predicated on fiat currency. We need money, we print it. The Federal Reserve Bank is a privately owned bank. It's not the U.S. government. Debt-based financing, where you have to borrow in order to grow. Fractional reserve banking, where banks can create all this money. And we live in the ultimate pyramid scheme. And it is called capitalism. And both Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a staunch Republican, and I called to say, this isn't capitalism. What we live in is organized crime. But it is predicated on a requirement of infinite growth. If there isn't growth for the shareholders' return, for the price-to-earnings ratio, for the return on investment, for revenues, the whole scheme collapses. And it's been on the brink of collapsing for some time. And pretty soon they're going to let it collapse. Why? Because for 50 years plus, there has been a 96% correlation between GDP growth, economic growth, and greenhouse gas emission. What's greenhouse gas emission? That's what you get when you burn hydrocarbon energy. You can't have economic growth without consuming burning energy. You open a business, you got to have lights. People got to get the product. You got to drive that product to the store. People got to come buy it. They got to go online. However you do business, you can't have economic growth without energy. So the most significant event in human history is when our screwed up economic system and our screwed up political system and our demented leaders who are driving this planet off a cliff, and I haven't even gone into ecology yet because that's not in the book. Maybe I'll get to that in some other book. But we all know that we're like having a little ecological collapse taking place around us now, right? The demand for infinite growth has just collided with finite energy. It will be the end of economics as we know it. Now, how many of you can gather that there will not be a solar-powered aircraft carrier? There will not be a hydrogen-powered fuel cell F-16 with Amory Lovins in the cockpit, okay? Fuel cells are a joke. Hydrogen is a chimera, okay? Hydrocarbon energy and oil has made this possible. So, one of my favorite impersonations, which I am known for, I do accents from time to time, can you all not picture Henry Kissinger sitting back in his chair and saying, "Well, the problem is not that there's too little oil. The problem is just that there are too many people." Okay. So as we look at this, this is what happened to world population as a result of hydrocarbon energy. This is years Anno Domini from the death of Christ. This little dip right here is the bubonic plague. Right along here, we came back and we started to get steam, and then we got coal, and then we got oil. And look at what the world's population has done. It will be 9 billion people by 2050 on this planet if it doesn't change. And, of course, it's already changing. Supported by hydrocarbon energy. Now, right after 9/11, some of this work FTW did two and a half years ago. Those of you who have been subscribing will know that I was predicting all this stuff 2.5, 3 years ago. And, you know, again, I thank Catherine Austin Fitz. Once you have the map, you're not a genius anymore. All you're doing is reading the map. The tough part is making the accurate map. And then anybody can read it. But that's why I did this book for you. Now you have the map and you can read it. And see, nobody is as smart as all of us together. I've done a lot of spiritual work over the years, and I love Carl Jung. He's one of my favorite guys. And you know, he talks about a collective consciousness. And we have to, you know, ultimately the human race is being posed with a question here by a very dispassionate universe, or God, whoever she is. I don't know who God is. I don't understand God. I know there is one, because she saved my life a lot, or he, or it, whatever. But the dispassionate question that the universe really could not give a shit about right now is looking at the human race and saying, either evolve or perish. We don't care. Life will go on without the human race. Who the hell are we, us egotistical, maniacal, self-centered sons of bitches, to believe that the whole universe revolves around us? The universe is laughing at us. So, but we drew this map 2.5 years ago and said, gee, I looked at the troop deployment since 9/11. I said, it doesn't kind of seem like we've surrounded the terrorists, but we sure have surrounded all the oil. And we did. Saudi Arabia probably peaked in 2000. Now, I reported on this. Like, I went to a peak oil conference in Paris, and I talk about this in the book, in 2003, before I went to the one in Berlin this year. And I came back with some tidbits saying that Saudi Arabia had possibly peaked. And it sure looks like they're getting close, because I love clipping these news stories side by side, day after day. You know, Saudi Arabia promises to increase production.
Saudi Arabia can increase production. Saudi Arabia vows next month it will increase production. Bullshit, Saudi Arabia can increase production. And they haven't. They have increased production of the heavy sour oil, but they can increase production of light sweet. You know, Russia's got a little bit of swing capacity, but where is all the swing coming from now? West Africa. And that, ladies and gentlemen, forget Iran. The next fight is going to be in West Africa. And I've been saying that for 2.5 years. And lo and behold, what is some of the well, let's just look at some of what's unfolded over this last year. For those who think I'm making up peak oil because I'm part of a Zionist conspiracy and I'm secretly in the employ of all the oil companies. Quiet, Mark. How many people saw this in National Geographic this summer? ABC dried up. Are we running out of oil? ABC. Major oil headlines over the last year, and I'm not going to read them all to you. BBC, Interpress News Agency, Moscow Times, Jane's, Foreign Policy and Focus, ABC News, Sunday Times, The Economist, BBC, U.S. News, Asia Times, Foreign Affairs, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Associated Press. I mean, they're talking about peak oil now, and it's kind of hard to ignore at this point. And I'm going to get to the end of this because I had one of the biggest ahas of my life here recently. Boy, hey, listen, I went for 26 years without having a whole lot of ahas, I got to tell you. It took me 2.5 years to write that book, and that I was pregnant for 2.5 years with that book. For any woman who's ever been pregnant, I know exactly how you feel. I thought it was going to kill me. I wanted out. I understand the saying. Sizing up the competition 2 years ago from the Wilderness Road, this was September 25th, 2002. Is China the end game? I have one of the most incredible energy editors in the world, Dale Allen Pfeiffer. And that man, if you've been following Dale's writing for all these years, you know how far ahead he's been of every major press organization in the world, those of you who have been reading FTW? My God. I've attracted some wonderful people. Here's a map, a couple key places I want you to remember on the map. Who stole my pen? All right. I autographed the last book for who? You have my pen. Oh, wait a minute. I got another one. All right, here's the Middle East right here. This is the Straits of Hormuz, controlled by Iran, by the way. If we invade Iran, Iran can block the Straits of Hormuz and nothing gets out of the Persian Gulf. We're not going to invade Iran. I mean, that's nuts. But here's China, the ultimate end game. And I'm going to scare you to death with some numbers about that. But let's just put this in context. This is the Caspian. They were going to try to build a pipeline out through here when they thought there was oil in the Caspian. But that changed before 9/11. And it followed perfectly with the timing of, let's go get Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. Oh, let's go invade Iraq. No oil in the Caspian. Let's go to Iraq. China has now decided to build a pipeline from here across Burma to a terminal. And this is basically a Chinese province now. So that the oil tankers can come and dock here and China can get the oil straight. Why? Because this is the heaviest, most heavily traveled sea lanes in the world, and we're going to have a major war in this region too, because there's a little oil in here in an area called the Spratly Islands. This is the heaviest traveled sea lanes in the world, and you have China, the Philippines, Australia, Indonesia, and the U.S. Navy controlling this area, and there's going to be a major war here. So China says, no, I want a pipeline right here. That way the tankers don't have to risk, and it's much shorter, obviously, to get the oil to China that way. And there's a big battle between China and Russia. But now, if you look at these curves on consumption, it's kind of interesting. This is U.S. oil consumption from 1960, roughly, until now. This is Chinese consumption. But I will show you in a story in a minute that the Chinese economy, you realize, is growing at 8 to 10% a year, right? China has passed Japan as the second largest oil importing nation in the world. What the projected numbers said is that the Chinese increase in demand between now and 2020 will exceed the amount of oil that we consume today, the U.S. In other words, this line, do you see where it's just starting to go up like this? It's going up like that. Now, where is that oil coming from if we've passed the peak of production or we're at the peak of production? Back in May 14th of 2002, I think it was, 2003, I don't know, some time ago, We talked about West Africa and what was going to happen in West Africa. U.S. and China are on a collision course over oil. China's rising grain prices could signal global food crisis. Everybody get, now remember, 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food. Chinese grain harvests have dropped for the past 5 straight years. Old Lou Dobbs, you know, the guy who wants to make you afraid of every illegal alien in the world, who won't talk about what's really going on, he reported about 8-10 months ago that the only two countries to export grain, the U.S. and Canada, would soon no longer be able to. Why? Because our grain harvests are dropping off, because our soil has become nothing more than sponges onto which we pour chemicals, and it's becoming depleted. Just recently had 7 carrier strike groups underway for an exercise this summer. 7 carrier battle groups, Summer Pulse 04, and guess where it took place? In the South China Sea, right off the Chinese coast. We call that a clue. U.S. Navy plans West Africa exercise. We have given 6 warships to Nigeria, which is now on the brink of revolution. You've all been hearing about Darfur, which is being pumped up as the new cause célèbre. Yeah, there's people dying in Darfur, and it's not a good thing. But the U.S. is hyping it, and Colin Powell is hyping it, because China has the largest oil investment in the country of Sudan, and they're after Sudan's oil, and we don't want China to get Sudan's oil. So we'll create a genocide so we can go to Sudan and intervene. Oh. The China effect, Washington Post, this is where it says the bottom line. Listen to this, Washington Post, this is October 14th. Today's the 20th, that's 6 days ago. You see, I'm on top of it. I'm on top of it. All right, listen to this. On the other hand, China's growth represents an enormous addition to global demand, perhaps enormous enough to overwhelm whatever extra supply is forthcoming. There ain't no extra supply forthcoming. The Economist magazine recently gave one measure of China of the China shock. Quote, The Economist, that's from Britain. I mean, that's pretty highly, that's heavy stuff, highly regarded. Very stuffed church, you know, very British, you know. The Economist said, the increase in China's energy consumption over the next 20 years is likely to exceed the total U.S. current consumption. The increase in Chinese consumption will exceed what we're using now. We use about 20 million barrels a day, of which we import about 10 or 11 million barrels a day. Where is this oil coming from? We sure haven't found any. I wish these abiotic oil fools would kind of run up and tell everybody where the oil is. I swear it is not under my patio. Okay? And if anybody here is hiding all this abiotic, limitless oil, please bring it now. China's demand for African oil helps boost gasoline prices. Why? Because China's moving into the Sudan, into Chad, into Angola. They're investing in Nigeria. China's moving all over West Africa. Now, why is West Africa so important? Do they have a lot of oil? No. All told, West Africa may have, I'm probably going to butcher this, but it's in the book, and I know it's on the website, the exact number. I'll say somewhere around 60 billion barrels of ultimately recoverable oil. Remember, a billion barrels every 11 and a half days. The difference, it takes 6 weeks to get a drop of gasoline from the Persian Gulf into your gas tank. It takes 2 weeks to get a drop of oil from West Africa into your gas tank. Do you see the difference? The world is producing at capacity now. For those of you who have been watching, you have Hugo Chavez burps one day. Oil prices go up $5. Russia says it can increase production by 2 million barrels a day. Prices go down 5 because everybody is so concerned about supply. There is no elasticity left anywhere in the system. That's why Hugo Chavez, about 6 months ago, and I'm quoting from a Reuters story, could successfully call President Bush an asshole and get away with it. And what Hugo Chavez said was, if you try another coup in my country, Hugo Chavez's other great line was, I have won 6 elections in the last 5 years. How many has your president won? Okay. I love that one. Hugo Chavez, after he called Bush an asshole, said, if the U.S. tries another coup in Venezuela, it only takes 4 days to get Venezuelan oil into your gas tank. 4 days. Venezuelan oil is Citgo. Okay? Hugo Chavez said, you try another coup in my country, I'll stop selling oil to America altogether. You know what happened 2 weeks later? And I have this slide, and I showed it in one of my other presentations. A Chinese delegation was in Caracas, Venezuela, less than a month later negotiating to buy anything that Hugo Chavez wanted to sell. U.S. struggles to encircle China. China's new African oil ties create concerns. That's from the Voice of America. Now, for all of you astute researchers, what government agency is the Voice of America affiliated with? You pass. Clash of Asian titans over West African oil, but it's not just China, it's India. Do you know that in the last 2 months, both China and India have begun crash programs to create a strategic petroleum reserve? In other words, they're starting to hoard oil while they can get it at under 60 a barrel. China warns of more power cuts. Now, this is where it starts to get really spicy. China is already having blackouts and brownouts. I have this great quote in this story that I think I will show you here. But it was a Burmese official who was talking to the Chinese government. And he said, China's need for oil is desperate and urgent. They're having blackouts in Shanghai and all the major industrial cities. They have to shut down the cities. Now, what does that do if you happen to be a Toyota plant in China? Or you happen to be a GM plant in China? Or you happen to be a Microsoft plant in China? And you're losing and you can't produce because, Now we see what happens when a highly complex, interconnected... What's that game you play where you stack up all the little things and you pull out one and you pull out one and then the last, you know, the idiot is the guy who pulls out one and the whole thing falls down? That's what we're living in. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. And the power cuts are not just happening in China. They're happening in, guess where? Brunei? Wait a minute, that was an oil power. Yeah, they peaked a long time ago. And the Bruneian parliament has just called an emergency session because they're looking at energy shortages. So is the Australian government. So is the Scottish government. So is the Irish government. In Thailand, they're having blackouts and they're having to shut out because they can't find the energy to generate electricity. In America, we're doing fine for the time being. You know why? We stopped building natural gas power plants. We started 120 new coal-fired plants. Now, anybody here worried about the environment? And I love the commercials. Clean coal. They call it clean because it has 45% less emissions than the old coal that is collapsing the ecosystem anyway. 45 to 60%. It's still dirty. Why? Because we have coal. And I was in, so we go nuclear. You want to go nuclear? Okay, let's talk about nuclear for a minute. Well, I had a very interesting conversation. I get to do another foreign accent this way. I love to do accents. I was in Berlin, and I was talking to a member of the French Parliament, a green member of the French Parliament. His name is Yves Cochet. And France is about 65, 70% nuclear right now. And he says, let me tell you the funny thing about nuclear. We will have to build more. And every month, a truck drives out of each nuclear reactor with the plutonium. And each one of those is a dirty bomb. And all you have to do is hit one of those trucks with an RPG, and you kill 200,000 people. Now, if we build more nuclear reactors, we will have probably no more than 200 of those trucks a month driving around France. Does that make you feel safe? I mean, there is no combination of alternative energy that will replace hydrocarbon energy. None. And allow the human race to continue consuming the way it does now. None. The infrastructure changes alone take 30 years. So let's say tomorrow we had a new technology. There are 700 million internal combustion-powered vehicles on the planet. So let's say tomorrow there was a new technology. Okay, now so you got to build 700 million new cars. You know how much energy goes into making a new car? 12%. 12 to 15% of all the gasoline it's going to consume in its lifetime goes into making the car. The National Geographic story said 7 gallons of oil in every tire. So you want 2.8 billion new tires times 7 gallons of oil. You have to look at a thing called net energy. Infrastructure changes take 30 years. Hydrogen is an absolute joke. It's a chimera. Forget Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, I will build a hydrogen highway. I'll pump you up. Yeah, sure. You know, bullshit. Electric Vehicle Magazine just reported that the best fuel cell engine, hydrogen fuel cell engine, has a 200-hour life expectancy. Would you want to buy a new engine for your car every 200 hours worth of use? They're pretty expensive. The problem is not that I know this. The problem is that Dick Cheney and the fascists and the Malthusians and the elitists have known this already, I know, for 30, 40, 50 years. And they're that far ahead in their plan. And that's what scares me. China warns of more power cuts. Greenspan finally admits, well, okay, the economy may start to contract a little bit now that we're getting to $60 a barrel. You know, it's going to 80 a barrel. You know, but here's a story I broke, and finally, just 2 weeks ago, this story was dated October 1. Reuters does some pretty accurate financial reporting, but you got to weed through it. The G7, everybody know what the G7 is, right? The seven largest industrialized economies on the planet issued an official statement. I'll paraphrase. We have no idea how much oil is left because all the books are cooked. Remember, Shell had to downgrade its reserve estimates 4 times last year. El Paso has done it because oil companies, let me tell you a little bit about reserves. Let's say I'm a big oil company and I find a field with a lot of oil in it, okay? And what I want to do is I have to declare it. So if I declare a field with, say, 2 billion barrels of oil, a couple things happen. First of all, I have to pay taxes on 2 billion barrels of oil in that year. Oh. Accountant says, no, wait, hold it. Maybe you better declare 20% of that this year and 20% over the next 5 years. Now, people who want to believe that there's a lot of oil will say, see, the oil fields are filling up because the accountants are finding more oil in the fields. That's how insane this is. All right. The other thing is that oil companies, if they find a whole big field 1 year and they declare it, their stock price goes way up. But if they don't find any oil in the ensuing 4 years, their stock price goes down. And their whole concern in this economy is the protection of the stock price, the shareholders' investment, price-to-earnings ratio. Okay, the economic analysis about oil is that the idiots like Daniel Yergin and others who insist that by throwing money at it, you can create oil. Using the same logic, if I lock you up in a bank vault and give you $1 billion, you can materialize a hot dog. But you can't, can you? The G7 have admitted they don't know how much oil there is. That was a monumental admission. Even in their story, it said, the officials will set out their worldview at 5:45, and a communique source has said would include a call to bolster oil market monitoring to make it easier to discern if scarce supply, hefty demand, or market speculation lay behind crude's drive to record levels. If you read further in the story, they say they don't think it's speculation. They think it actually might be geology. That's the G7. That was October the 1st, 19 days ago. 2005 is the year when it all falls apart. Now, the good news is it's going to get much worse in 2007, so you have like 2 years of it being really bad before it gets unbelievable. What happens in 2007, we know, because we know what mega fields have been discovered, what fields are coming online or in various states of development, and when their products will come on stream to the market. And by 2007, it is an absolute mathematical certainty that supply will fall far below demand, and there will be no place to go. Now we're just going to go kill people to take their oil. Remember Dick Cheney and George Bush saying, the American way of life is not negotiable? Somebody else had better start negotiating pretty quickly. The bottom line to all of this, I'll save a little piece of jovial news. I don't think I've given you any good news all night, so I don't know why you're smiling. Crossing the Rubicon means a great many things. In 49 BC, Julius Caesar broke the law of the old Roman Republic, which said that no Roman legion could ever cross the boundary of Rome and enter Rome and no legion could ever be there. It was like check your swords at the door, or check your six guns, you know, at the city limits. In 49 BC, Julius Caesar took a Roman legion and entered Rome, and the Roman Republic died and the Roman Empire was born. But it also represents, metaphorically speaking, a turning point, a point from which there is no return and no going back. We have crossed several Rubicons since 9/11. Our republic is dying. Our civil rights are being taken away. There is a madman in the White House, and probably also a madman who speaks a little more nicely, who is probably not as demented, but who is following the same agenda, seeking to replace him. And it's a Rubicon for the planet as a whole. Because once this game, once the inertia of dealing with peak oil is set in motion, that it will be survival of the fittest, we're all doomed. There's only one way that can play out, and we have a very short window of time in which we can stop that. Now, to leave you with, before I shut up and take your questions, to leave you with a piece of good news, I've been predicting now for 2 years, and those of you who also follow this will see that there's a feud underway between the CIA and the Bush White House. And I've been talking about this from back when I wrote Beyond Bush 1 and Beyond Bush 2, which is well more than a year and a half ago, where I saw that the CIA was fighting back. And this has to do with the Valerie Plame case. It has to do with the forged Niger documents, the way intelligence was abused. And I predicted it was possible that there would be indictments before the election. Well, I still think it's possible. I think it's unlikely. But it's a certainty that if Bush is elected, the impeachment will begin almost immediately. Good news and bad news. I mean, it's like, be careful what you pray for. Because an impeachment begun in the interregnum between the election and the next term will almost certainly indicate that the United States government on the world stage is going to be crippled. And our positions overseas are going to become, that's going to become very spicy. Bush, the CIA is Wall Street, period. That's one of my early chapters in the book. If you don't get it, get it. The CIA is a creation of Wall Street, always has been, always will be. Bush is bad for business. He's good for Halliburton business, but he's bad for American business as a whole. That's why George Soros wants him so badly removed. But I predicted that there would be some indictment. Everybody familiar with the Valerie Plame case, the CIA agent who was outed by Karl Rove? Well, I said this might happen, and it just happened on the 15th, which is 5 days ago. Karl Rove was called to testify before the federal grand jury in the Plame case, and both George Bush and Dick Cheney have retained criminal defense lawyers in that case. So that may be coming. All that means is that now we may have a civil war at home on top of a world war, a massively unstable world situation. Next year is going to be ugly. I'm sorry. You know, so there's something going on here, but we are making some progress. Before... I'm working on a story now, which is probably one of the biggest stories I've done in FTW's 6-year history. Recently, I saw a story talking about how they're doing a massive tax-based investment off of Nantucket. Anybody ever been to Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard? You ever notice that the rich folks live there? The really rich folks live there? To build an offshore wind farm to generate electricity with wind. The whole tax base, which includes poorer regions of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, is paying for that wind farm, but it will only supply Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. The rich people have known peak oil was coming for a long time. If you live here in California, I know of two very large patches of wind farms in California. Where are they? One's right by Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, is it not? No government installations there, are there? No rich real estate around there, is there? The other one is in between Banning and Palm Springs, California. There's no rich people in Palm Springs, is there? But these alternate energies, while they look nice and appeal to liberals, you do the math because electricity is very, very ironclad and unyielding. It only flows to the closest source. And all these are being located near rich zip codes. And they're going to use your tax dollars to do it and deny that peak oil is happening all the while. We've crossed a lot of Rubicons, so I need your help. This is our book. This is our struggle. This is our life. This is our species. And I refuse to let my species or its worth in the universe be defined by the maniacs that are driving this planet off a cliff. This is going to be a very tough fight. I have given you a map. If you don't have this book, buy this book. Buy it for me. Why do I want you to buy it for me? It's the Walmart syndrome. You know what the Walmart syndrome is, right? You go to Walmart, the profits go back to Arkansas. All right, you buy it from me, the profits go to From the Wilderness, and I get to hire more writers and give you more information. That's why we brought these books with us. You can buy them from our website. You buy them from us because I've kept my promise. All my money has gone back into giving you more and better information. I've given you this book, but you have given me life. You have kept me going. And I thank you for having me here tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.